Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the meeting of the Governance Committee. The first item on our agenda this morning is approval of the agenda. I'd like to make one modest amendment to the agenda with the approval of the committee, and that is we seem to have a consensus on the board as to how to proceed with respect to the nomination of a slate of officers to lead us forward, and I thought we might just do that first. Should not take long, since I gather there is a consensus. With that, I would ask for approval of the amended agenda.
Second.
A motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the vote will occur on the motion. All in favor will vote aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. The agenda is approved. The next item is the approval of the minutes of our meeting of January 10. I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
Mr. Chairman, I move approval.
Second. I have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion, any proposed changes to the minutes? Hearing none, the vote occurs on the motion. All in favor will vote aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. The minutes are approved. Then the first item we'll take up will be approval of the 2013 board officer nominations, which will be presented to the board. I would move that the committee nominate Tom Downs of the District of Columbia for chair, Mort Downey for vice chair, first vice chair, and Alvin Thornton's a buddy of mine, and Alvin Nichols is a buddy of mine. Alvin Nichols for second vice chair.
I'll second that, Mr. Chairman.
We have a motion and a second. Is there discussion? Hearing none, the vote will occur on the motion. All in favor will vote aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Those nominations are unanimously moved to the board. The next item on our agenda is also extremely important for WMATA, maybe even more important for WMATA, and that is the consideration of something we've all been working on for over a year and a half, and that is our strategic plan. Later we're going to take up a code of ethics, which is obviously also extremely important for WMATA. But over the last several months, as you know, our general manager and his team have been gathering comments and suggestions on the strategic framework that we have developed, and they've also been busy preparing what I think is really an excellent draft of a strategic plan for the future of WMATA. This morning, our managing director of planning, Shum Kanaan, will present the findings of that extensive outreach process, as well as present some highlights of the staff draft. And we've talked about it, and to facilitate discussion, we thought we'd break this into two different places. So have a presentation, and we'll have a break for questions, and then further presentation, break for questions, rather than interrupt Shum as he's going through the presentation, if that's acceptable. We'll have plenty of time for questions, but try to do it in an organized way. With that, I will turn it over to Mr. Kanaan and Ms. Richardson and Mr. Sarles to lead us off here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing us today. As we are all aware, Metro has been rebuilding inside and out, and we're already starting to see the strides in safety, reliability, our organizational culture, governance improvements. And the public is beginning to see this as well. To remind us all, 18 months ago, the board challenged Metro leadership to embark upon the process of a strategic plan. And today, for the next slide, today we're here to report back to you on the outreach that's been conducted over the last several months that inform our understanding of what it is that the strategic plan can and should contain, as well as to convey to you information that's emerging from the ongoing technical analyses that Metro leadership is conducting to build a system that's built for the next generation of Metro. We're also here to present to you the staff draft of Momentum, which is the name we've given to this draft strategic plan. This staff draft right now represents a starting point for discussion. Clearly, there's much work to be done, and we believe that it is not only a discussion starter, but also a foundation for a robust level of debate and discussion about the future of the organization as well as the region. Next slide. We remember that after the board endorsed the strategic framework, which you can see behind me, the staff began at least three different processes. First of all, we began to compile and synthesize technical analyses and forecasting that informed our understanding of what it is that the mobility needs as well as the competitiveness needs of the region are today and will be in the future. We also simultaneously began gathering an extensive amount of feedback from the region stakeholders, our riders, our non-riders, the business community, advocacy groups, our public stewards, to help us truly understand what our customers and our customers to be today and tomorrow want and need from the region's transit network. We reported back to you in November with a progress update indicating to you the work plan and the proposed level of outreach. The next few slides I'm going to detail for you at a high level what that outreach has told us about Metro today and what Metro needs to be tomorrow, as well as what the regional transit system today is and what it needs to be tomorrow to satisfy this region's mobility needs and to support its competitiveness. Go to the next slide. You'll see images that depict what for us has been a process of gathering tens of thousands of bits of input into the strategic planning process. The importance of outreach has been eminent in this process from the start. We know that in crafting the strategic framework, there's a significant amount of internal and external outreach that was conducted. This is no different. Listening to our customers, our regional stakeholders, the business community, and our public stewards is something we take very, very seriously, and rightly so. We wanted to gather as much raw input as possible so that this staff draft could be not only proactive in understanding what the region needs, but really responsive to what our current customers and customers-to-be need. In order to do this, we used a combination of both traditional and non-traditional methods to gather this input. You can see behind me some of the indicators from our traditional methods of outreach gathering, our newspaper ads, our online surveys, handouts on buses that gathered individual pieces of information that we were able to compile and analyze. In all, we engaged over 11,000 and more stakeholders in this conversation. This included customers, the general public, jurisdictional and federal funders, key regional civic and advocacy groups, and of course, Metro's own employees. We did this through a combination of newspaper ads, consumer research surveys, made sure that we were using as many languages as possible in that surveying and in our ad and newspaper outreach. The online tools that we deployed were available in multiple languages, I believe 65 at least, and we made sure to not only put our advertisements in the papers, but make sure that we were advertising as well as communicating in papers in different languages. You can also see behind me this in the upper left-hand corner, we also engaged and used innovative technologies, in fact, a crowdsourcing tool, if you will, to gather input and actually engage the public in a two-way interactive dialogue. This was posted on a site called MindMixer. And what this allowed us to do is it allowed us to test ideas and actually engage in some level of education for the general public, as well as then gauge inputs and reactions to a variety of proposals that could, in fact, be part of the strategic plan, and also to solicit new ideas from the general public. This was a tool that was very widely used. We certainly had many, many thousands of respondents, over 11,000 visits, and over 7,200 of those visits were from unique individuals that were contributing information. What this left my team to do is sort through a mountain of data, which is a lot of fun for folks like me. But this also included, in some of the non-traditional outreach, convening essentially a Delphi panel of regional experts that helped us engage leadership and the regional leadership in an honest discussion about what this transportation network as a whole, as well as the transit network in the region that's part of the transportation network, needs to be in order to support economic competitiveness and growth over the next 40 years. If you go to the next slide, You can see images from some of the outreach activities that were, in fact, conducted. Another form of non-traditional outreach we engaged in was a series of deliberative forums where we invited a combination of riders and some non-riders that were representative of our total ridership base to spend half a day with us and to learn more about how Metro operates, how it's funded, what the challenges are, as well as then to give us honest feedback and ideas for helping to solve some of the problems today and plan for tomorrow. In all, we had these deliberative forums in each jurisdiction, and one was conducted entirely in Spanish, and that helped us not only see point sources of information, but also hear what the conversation looked like at the personal level, understand from our most important, our customers, what it was that Metro could do to make their daily lives better, and how we could, in fact, support their aspirations for living in the region. We also sent surveys to our SmartTrip user database, as well as kept them apprised of ongoing activities with monthly emails using our Facebook and our Twitter networks. We conducted over 40 presentations to regional stakeholders, including those in the advocacy community and civic groups, including Region Forward, which is a combination of regional planning leaders and the TPB, including business groups such as the DCBIA and Urban Land Institute, and, of course, individual presentations to city and county leadership. This also included some sharing of information with planning and transportation agencies. So all of this is to say that we've gathered a tremendous amount of information. This has informed our thinking to date. It's also to say that this is really still just the beginning. We have a tremendous amount of outreach that's planned for the spring of this year, I guess the end of the winter into spring, including additional outreach to the business community and to community groups and to our public stewards. We need to make sure that once we have an idea on the table that's ripe for discussion, that we continue to engage those folks that have been speaking with already, as well as invite additional participants into this conversation. Let's go to the next slide. So what do they tell us? Well, we had thousands and thousands of bits of information, which we did and we continue to do. And the fascinating thing, perhaps the most startling thing in taking a look at all of these discrete bits of information, is that there were some very, very strong common themes that rang true that were shared by our business leaders, by our civic leaders, by our advocacy groups, by our customers, by our riders, and by our non-riders. We've summarized them at a very high level in the slide behind me. They're given to you in more detail, not only in the draft report that you have, the draft strategy you have, but also in the staff report on the stakeholder outreach. If we were to summarize it as follows, these would be the themes. First and foremost, Metro is absolutely critical to the region's future. This is a system that is not simply about mobility. This is part of the regional DNA. It is a circulatory system for the region, the bus, rail, and paratransit network, and that making sure that we continue the work of rebuilding and rehabilitating the system so that it can serve today's needs is great. We also need to be thinking about having a system that's built for tomorrow's needs. There's unequivocal support for making sure that this piece of our regional infrastructure is tended to and cared for and nurtured. The feedback also informed us that our job is not to approach this in piecemeal or with half measures, but rather to make grand plans. That the solution to the region's transportation, mobility, and competitiveness needs are big. Big ideas, big thinking is called for. And the charge given to us in the feedback is to make no small plans, but to rather make large plans and to execute them. The creation of Metro itself was the result of large visioning, big picture thinking, and we are being challenged again to do the same for the next generation. The progress that we're making in the rebuilding campaign is certainly appreciated, and the directive given to us is to keep rebuilding, keep at it. The improvements that we're seeing in on-time performance and escalator availability and the fleet improvements that we're making, the service improvements that we're making are much appreciated, and there is a very clear consensus that we need to finish this job and finish it right. Crowding seems to be a significant concern amongst all of our riders and non-riders. In some ways, we may be seen as victims of our own success. We have so many riders today on a network that has not kept pace with population and employment growth in the region. And our job is to make sure that the customer experience is one that's not only convenient and on time and easy to navigate, but also comfortable. And to the extent that we can make sure that our riders' experience is one that does not include standing room only platforms, trains, and buses, but actually a comfortable riding experience, we go a long way to earning additional goodwill from the riding public and non-riding public. Today, we live in an information age. We have for a long time, and our customers demand and deserve information all the time, everywhere. if we think about what was unveiled technology-wise in 1976, the Cray computer was 4 tons and had a little bit less computing capacity than this mobile device. There's no reason why we can't employ and deploy to our region's customers technology that is best in class globally and allow them to navigate the region's transit network effortlessly and seamlessly. They want more information to be able to make their trips and make their trip planning decisions, payments, and navigation absolutely intuitive, and we absolutely can do that. And finally, regardless of who we talk to, those that were educated about the way that Metro is funded, and those that needed to be educated about the way Metro is funded came to the one singular conclusion. We have to ensure reliable, sustainable, and stable funding for Metro. There's no other way to do this. There's no other way around it. And the need for a sustainable and reliable source of funding to make sure that we can plan for the future, both operating and capital, is something that the public, our riding public, business community, civic and advocacy groups, and our regional stewards strongly support. And with that, I believe we're going to take a quick pause and make sure that there aren't any questions about the material so far.
I'd like to delve a little further into the last bullet. So we're at 30,000 feet on this issue of reliable, stable funding. And the region's faced this question on numerous occasions in the past. Can you tell us what options the respondents gave you to consider? Can you break it down by Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia?
It might be the way we gathered the research, and it might be more accurate for us to report back to you, which we have done not only in this staff draft, but also in your report, your outreach report, the response by class of respondents. So if I may direct you in your draft report, your staff draft to page 22, which summarizes the stakeholder outreach. I'll do my best to put this in a couple packages. First and foremost, we know that every transit system in the nation has a unique capital stack. And I use that term from a financial perspective, not necessarily from the perspective of Metro, where we discuss capital and operating funds. And I think it behooves all of us to make sure that a system which has a unique funding capital stack today continues to have a unique one tomorrow. There's going to be no one-size-fits-all solution. What we heard from the customer base is that they're concerned about the cost and also the time necessary to prepare for the future. The fact that a long-term discussion about funding and some never-ending process about theoretical funding isn't going to get the job done. I'll highlight that not only did on the bottom right-hand side of that of page 22, the customers were most interested in committing some portion of their existing transportation fees. So vehicle registration, title taxes, et cetera, and that may include usage fees to public transit. The business community, of course, had their own set of ideas and responses, but if you go to the next page, when we did interview 150 C-suite executives, 70% of them indicated that however we do this, we have to make sure it's done. There's no one response or one type of funding solution that emerged as the answer. We have presented to you in the tail end of this report, I can direct you to the exact page, the results of the online survey, but also we've presented to you in previous board memos as well as in this document a summary of how other transit systems in the nation are approaching this. And the challenge, I think, to all of us is to take a look at the existing information that has been compiled and presented and do the hard work of coming up with a unique solution for Metro.
Page 48.
Yes, that summary is on page 48 of your staff draft.
Yeah, a point that you made that I would just like to emphasize even more strongly. This plan has to be a balanced approach that starts with maintaining what we have, deals with some short-term issues, and includes a vision for the future. And I get concerned because it's very easy to jump over one and two and get focused on what's bright, new, and glitzy. I think that was the coverage that we saw this morning. Very expected. But we can't lose sight of what really needs to be done on a continuing basis. It's the foundation on which we can get people persuaded that long-term there are things that we can accomplish that are good for the region. But we never let up. You made one point I didn't agree with. You made the comment that we're in a rebuilding that will at some point be finished. That's what you said. And he didn't mean to say it. Right. That's why I mean to correct it. We're never finished. We're never finished with that. If we ever get to the point of saying we're finished with that, it means we've started down the slope again. And we just should never, never make that point.
That's correct. I apologize for the mistake. To go to the next slide, you'll see the architecture of what this strategic plan provides for the organization. You know, at a very high level, strategic plans provide direction and guidance for an organization through a 10 to 15 year life cycle and give specific direction to shorter term business plans. They set funding priorities, they set organizational priorities, they give an organization a sense of what it wants to do, where it wants to be, and how it plans to get there. And like all sound strategic plans, Momentum has been designed to support the achievement of the board's strategic framework, its vision and mission and goals. You'll see that within each goal is a set of strategies and strategic actions that Metro will use to guide our investments and decision-making over the next 10 years. And of course, in support of Momentum are the GM's business, is the GM's business plan and budget, which you've been discussing over the last several months. We're going to be constantly reviewing the business plans as they cycle in and cycle out and use them not only to measure the execution of the business plans, but also the extent to which those business plans help Metro achieve its strategic goals. This foundational element, the fact that the strategic plan gives the business plans direction and allows us to set a 10-year vision for what we aim to accomplish, is key to aligning ourselves from the inside, aligning ourselves on the outside, and making sure that we actually make good on the promises that we're making to our region. So with this as a foundational backdrop, and you can see going from right to left, we see the strategic goals that this board has endorsed. We have constructed with feedback, input from the feedback we've gathered, as well as from technical analyses, strategies to accomplish our safety goal, strategies to accomplish our customer service and quality service goals, strategies to better connect communities, and strategies to ensure financial stability. I'm going to walk you through highlights of what is given in more detail in your staff draft in the next few slides. So our commitment, a Metro ride is a safe ride. We at Metro are committed to delivering a safer and more secure transit experience for the customers and for our employees. You know, our customers and employees not only deserve, but we can deliver for them a safe environment on the job, in the buses, on the trains, and in the stations and shelters. How do we get this done? Examples of things we can do right now, things we can work towards in order to achieve this premier safety culture and system include, Mr. Donahue, you alluded to this, first and foremost, we have to continue to fix and maintain the system. The system is under a rehabilitation effort right now, and there is no end date for that work. We're going to accomplish some of the elements that we've set out to achieve, but the instant those elements are quote-unquote completed, they require ongoing maintenance, and other elements of the system will continue to deteriorate and degrade as it gets used. So we're going to continue to complete all the NTSB recommendations, but also sustain the efforts to maintain Metro's goal of being a high reliability organization, as well as to sustain the level of effort and initiative that's being deployed right now to rehabilitate and rebuild the system. That is a continuous process that will never end. We also want to make sure that we work with our jurisdictional partners as well as other entities in the region to create a shared climate of safety. This means a better integration with our regional partners in policing. It means a better integration with our school districts. It means looking at the perhaps dissonance between some of the laws that need to be enforced as well as the penalties that are enforced and taking a look at the MOU that governs some of our policing activities and making sure that it's up to date. And if it's not, taking steps to make sure that it's up to date. It also means that internally embracing and continuing to embrace health and wellness as a means to provide the best level of employees on the job every single day and ensure top-notch employee performance. It also means using design. There are significant amounts of headway that have been made in environmental design. It's the way places are constructed, how they look and feel, things like lines of sight and lighting, landscaping and physical infrastructure that can not only create a climate of safety, but actually have create improvements in actual safety. So these are elements of really taking a shared approach to this climate of safety. We also know that in 2013 and beyond, we have to expect the unexpected. And that means making sure that the system is hardened against a potential man-made disaster, continuing to work to enhance the region's emergency transit management protocols, and internally, continuing to implement additional and stronger continuous feedback loops so that information is passed within the organization rapidly to decision makers who could prevent an accident before it might happen. And finally, it's not lost upon any of us that the 500-year storm is now the 2-year storm, and it makes sense for Metro to take a leadership in sustainability and embrace the fact that, you know, extreme weather is going to be more commonplace. This means having physical infrastructure as well as route planning and operations that can handle the 110-degree days or the deep freezes or the extensive rains and or weather events that may impact the physical moving about of people and goods as well as route planning. It also means coordinating with our regional communications providers, the news media, et cetera, so that the customer understands clearly the conditions in which there may be changes to service under specific conditions and needs not access additional information or read a technical manual to understand which lines or which routes may be affected under what conditions. Region-wide, it's not just a metro condition, this is a regional necessity. Go to the next slide. You know, we've heard our customers loud and clear, and we continue to hear our customers loud and clear. This region needs a transit system that is intuitive and simple to plan, pay, and ride. Here are the basics. We absolutely need to deliver on-time performance, predictably, reliably, and that's non-negotiable. The good news is that our on-time performance is up year over year, and we're going to continue to strive but nothing for the best in terms of delivering to our customers a predictably on-time ride to get folks where they want to go, when they want to go there safely and efficiently. We also need to then make sure that our stations and our vehicles, our buses and our rail cars and our paratransit vehicles are clean, are well-lit, they're comfortable. We want to avoid and get away from the need to squint in the dark to read reading material in stations, to get away from inaudible audio announcements, and to give the customer a pleasure, a comfortable experience on our mezzanines, on our platforms, on our vertical transportation, on our vehicles. And finally, fix it first means an aggressive approach to repairs and rehabilitations or replacements on or ahead of schedule to prevent service disruptions in the first place. Those are the basics, and that's really just the beginning. The reality is Metro was designed to be a self-service system, and we propose completing that journey. The customers need and deserve nothing less. And if we may imagine for a moment walking to a bus shelter, not needing to ask for route planning assistance, fare payment information, or walking directions, not needing to know what the timing, or not needing to ask for assistance in understanding the connection timing to the nearest rail station or the different departures from that station to different directions. A user experience that is entirely intuitive and one that lets you ride the region's transit network, not just Metro, but the region's transit network seamlessly without needing to think about it. It's not fanciful. This is actually an experience that our customers deserve and one that we can deliver. And imagine that the resources that can be redeployed to other areas of need if we can make a self-service, intuitive customer experience and transit experience for our regional transit consumer. And we can take this one step further. You know, Momentum posits that the regional traveler can and should be able to make trip planning decisions anywhere and everywhere. Now, today we have trip planning information that is a step in the right direction. You certainly can get online and make a regional trip planning decision based upon a variety of information that has been consolidated into a variety of places. But what we need to be able to do is to have real-time information on actual vehicle positions, locations, speeds, departures, and arrivals available to anyone, everywhere, and anywhere, on your mobile device, in kiosks, or in stations, in bus shelters, visible, clear, and prominent. so that we don't need to figure out how we don't want the customer to have to mentally distinguish between switching not only modes of transit but also transit providers. Imagine being able to get on commuter rail or to be able to get on one of our regional transit providers and not have to think about whether or not you're getting on the Dash, on the ART, on the bus, on Metrobus, on Ride-On, or Metro Rail, but actually viewing that as a singular, seamless transit ride. That is what creates the opportunity to capture more choice riders, and that's what allows us to maximize the impact of a regional mobility network. And paying for the trip should be easy. Paying for the trip should not require our customers to compute fares in their head or to calculate whether or not we're peak or off-peak and understand surcharges. We have now the technology out there in the world with chips in your credit cards. Many of you have them already that have near-field technology. Many of us tend to, again, not to hold this up again, but to make most of our purchases using mobile devices. Those technologies exist today, and it's up to us to deliver those technologies and be able to use those technologies to pay for the trip to our customers. And finally, what this also means is a radical upgrade to our platform and bus shelter information that puts real-time connections prominently in front of the customer across modes. The regional customer should be able to pack a suitcase, walk to a bus shelter, see real-time information on all of the nearby buses and their arrival times, get on that bus, get to a rail station, know which trains are coming next, and let's say as they ride that train into Dulles, get their flight departure and delay information displayed to them clearly. We have the technology to do this. The 7,000 series car is actually designed to do this. We need to implement that and can implement that for our customers. Let's go to the next slide. When Metro was conceived, it was designed to bring suburban commuters into downtown, and now we have multiple downtowns. Many of you may remember Bethesda when it was nothing more than a Bob's Big Boy and a fill station, and Shady Grove was in fact just that. And Arlington was in the process of making good on its of its promises of transit-oriented development. Frankly, the region has outgrown some of the service areas and that were designed originally, specifically the Metro Rail. And we also now have a proliferation and had always of transit agencies and proposed projects, each of which is attempting to solve the regional mobility problems on its own. As we listen and learn, not only to the general public, but also to regional transit leaders and planning leaders, the following fact emerged, that there's a void in regional transportation planning, regional transit planning, that there is no one regional transit leader that is stepping up and taking on the responsibility as well as the burden of drawing the regional transit map. Metro can and should be that transit leader. Not only does our compact give us that charge to in fact do so, but we are the only entity that is operating consistently across all three jurisdictions, and we're already in the process of coordinating many of the transit visions. Metro's charge can and should be to be the regional transit leader. And understanding that that is, Mr. Downey, something that is a laudable vision, if that doesn't mean that we can shirk our responsibility to squeeze every drop of capacity out of the existing system. And so making sure that we put in place the vehicles, the rail capacity, and the power traction to run eight-car trains, all eight-car trains during peak periods, and adding a 35% capacity addition to our rail network during the peak hour is critical. Making sure that we actually implement the Metrobus Priority Corridor Network, which is forecast to add 100,000 riders to the regional bus network, is critical. Making sure that we have improvements to our core stations so that we can handle the additional riders and do so in a manner that's comfortable is critical. And also doing what we can to fill what empty seats we do have in the system today is critical. So first things first, squeeze every drop of capacity out of the existing system. Also making sure that we have employed every innovative capacity to enhance access. And that means pedestrian connections, bike-ped connections, park sharing, and mobility solutions that are next generation for those with individual needs. And let me just remind everyone that as the region, which is evolving around these clusters of activity centers, continues to grow, two-thirds of the proposed activity centers in the most recent planning documents to come out of Region Forward depend on high-quality transit connections in order to thrive. In many cases, that high-quality transit is not there today. So it's our charge to make sure that as the region grows, we're extending high-quality transit to these activity centers, which in fact is, you know, the constellation of places that our region has become. And if we go to the next slide, this is the challenge in front of us is to find a way to pay for all of this. This does need to be paid forward in order for this vision to be realized, and actually to give the region the transit system it needs and deserves in order to continue to be globally competitive. We're calling on the region's transit leaders to face head-on the funding challenges that have contributed to the challenges customers experience today, and if not remedied, will prevent customers from enjoying the service they deserve tomorrow. We're going to do our part at Metro. We're going to make sure that we make investments for the long term, investments that are efficient because they are looking to 10 years out, 15 years out, and immediately squeeze efficiencies out. We're going to make sure that we create effective and affordable collective bargaining agreements, and make sure that we control cost overruns through discipline, absenteeism, and overtime. We're going to make sure that we squeeze efficiencies out of every place in this organization that we can. We're also going to make sure that we're a leader in sustainability and achieving a triple bottom line, which means not only being a sustainability leader in promoting cleaner air and cleaner water, but also achieving cost efficiencies through lower resource usage and reduction in consumption. We do need to aim higher and achieve more. We certainly need the region to do its part and work to create a funding structure for Metro that allows us to engage in multi-year budgeting so that we can, in fact, plan for and execute plans for the future. Assist us in constructing fair policies that are healthy for Metro, and most importantly, to put in place a system that guarantees a secure, stable, reliable, and sustainable funding source that allows us to not only plan for the future, but actually invest in the future. And with that, we're going to stop and make sure there are no questions. Questions?
I just hope that you give this talk three times a day to business groups, church groups, Rotary clubs, et cetera, over the next months throughout the region, because I thought it was wonderful presentation, Sean. Great job. And
thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'd like to call your attention to the slide in back of me as well. In thinking about what this means physically, as well as from a service standpoint, we've talked a lot about the financial needs, we've talked a lot about the cultural changes that are taking place and organizational discipline. Part of what's in your staff draft is also a series of concepts that we've dubbed, in first part, Metro 2025 and Metro 2040, which paint a picture of the transit system that the region will need in the future, as well as improvements that can be made to the transit system we have in order to make sure that we're prepared for the next decade. Let me just highlight what's in Metro 2025 for you, and there's more detail in your packet and in your documents. Clearly, tomorrow's Washington is going to require mobility solutions that not only alleviate today's system congestion, but also ones that connect new communities, ones that weren't here before, and deliver the safe and comfortable passenger experience that we've been discussing. And this slide shows a quick summary of those initiatives that we are calling 2025. In short, these are the investments that we need to make today so that Metro can catch up to the growth that's already happened, as well as be prepared for the growth that's forecast to take place over the next decade. And you'll notice that there are really three key elements that these all congeal around. Number one is squeezing every drop of capacity out of the existing network. Two, adding much-needed bus service and high-quality bus service to the regional consumer. We heard over and over again in our outreach that there was a tremendous need for additional bus service and attention on bus service. We want to make sure that's front and center. And three, delivering the information and communications infrastructure that I described in aspirational terms just now. So in terms of eight-car trains and getting and PCN, getting every drop out of the existing system, what providing eight-car trains during the peak period, 100% of our lines, does is allow the system capacity to grow and handle potentially an additional 35,000 riders in the peak direction during the peak period per day. Comfortably. It buys us an additional 10 to 15 years of capacity. And certainly for those of you who have been traversing some of our core stations and on our more crowded rail lines, you'll know that capacity is desperately needed. We'll also need to make sure then to make improvements to those core stations, including platform improvements, mezzanine improvements, vertical transportation, to handle the additional capacity that those eight-car trains will in fact convey to those stations. You know, things, places like Metro Center, Gallery Place, L'Enfant, these are already significantly crowded, and we want to make sure that if we do the hard work of getting the trains and the passengers, that we have the physical space in the platforms and mezzanines and escalators and elevators to handle that. The Metro PCN network, the Metro Bus PCN network, which was conceived over the last several years, is projected to add 100,000 new riders to the regional bus network, offering the opportunity to add significant mobility on the existing road network. We're going to need to not only have the buses to do this, but also the technology in terms of the traffic signal prioritization and coordination with our local jurisdictions to allow for these buses to bypass congestion and to move riders quickly through the region. And we've talked a lot about the customer technology, making sure that the customer can navigate our planning and payment network at a regional level seamlessly and efficiently and intuitively. These are all elements that the customer deserves today and which we have packaged together in what we're calling Metro 2025. And what this does, it keeps the region working well over the next decade, decade and a half. Realizing that this involves some level of catch-up for today's issues, we put on the next slide, as well as preparing for the next 10 years, at Metro, we're also cognizant of the fact that we have to walk and chew gum at the same time. And so we've taken the best forecasts that are out there and the forecasts that are adopted about the 1.6 million people and 1.5 million new jobs that are expected to be added to the region over the next 35 years and said, it is our responsibility. We owe it to our regional ridership to also be thinking about this. And so what you're seeing is a summary of very preliminary analysis, very, very preliminary thinking, conceptual in nature, of what the regional transit system might have to look like in order to keep up with regional growth and actually to support economic competitiveness going forward. And the list is it includes ongoing work, which is a regional transit system plan. This is a draft document that's available online for review on planetmetro.com. Phase one of that is really baseline conditions and some initial feasibility testing. We anticipate releasing it in mid-2013. But what this does, if we think about the components of the RTSP, this is the aspirational component that evaluates potentially new metro rail connections in the core, potential extensions, potential additions of additional high-quality surface transit, having a truly integrated commuter rail network that feeds seamlessly into and perhaps across jurisdictions, as well as additional service improvements to our rail, bus, commuter rail, and paratransit services. We believe that it's a good time to begin to ask these questions, and we've done the hard work of at least painting an aspirational picture conceptually of what this might look like. And, in fact, doing this planning work now is the responsible way to preparing for this growing region. All of this is going to require Metro 2025 as a precursor, and all of this is very conceptual at this point in time. But I want to make sure that you know that Metro is actually taking the lead and doing this hard work well ahead of schedule. Let's go to the next slide. So what do we get? It's no longer a secret that public transit equals private dollars and that Metro and the regional transit system delivers far more benefits than simply the mobility that it conveys to the region. I mean, today what we're doing is we're keeping a million auto trips off the road. We're keeping us from needing to build 200,000 parking spaces. That's 166 blocks of six-story parking garages in the region's core. We're keeping us from needing to build 1,000 new lane miles of roads. And not only are we doing that, but we're generating property value above and beyond that which jurisdictions would enjoy otherwise. It's $224 million a year, approximately, that our that the jurisdictions within the metro service area can use to pay for thousands of teachers, police officers, firefighters, every single year. By the way, I don't think the fact that Metro is actually paying for all these services is widely known. We're trying to make that information more readily available and to democratize that. So we're already delivering a regional return on investment that we made 35 years ago. We're Metro 2040, as it's painted right now, not only continues but expands that regional return on investment. Forecasts that the office has conducted suggest that Metro 2040 conveys to the region an incremental $37 billion in property value, which is, in rough terms, about $500 million per year in property tax revenues to the jurisdictions, that we're saving this regional consumer about $500 million a year in productivity due to lost travel time or potentially lost travel time, that we're keeping congestion lower by 10% in D.C. and Arlington, and certainly lower by almost that much in some of the outlying jurisdictions. that will reduce the need for parking demand. Without Metro 2040, our estimates suggest that we need to build another 45,000 parking spaces to the tune of almost $1 billion to accommodate that demand. So there is no doubt that if you take a look at what Metro 2040 is designed to do, there is a very strong regional return on that investment, and that does not even count the competitiveness benefits that it conveys to the region. We all know that, and this is detailed in your staff draft as well, regions with more public transit are more competitive. If you take a look at gross metropolitan product per metro area over the last 10, 20 years, those with more transit stations had higher gross metropolitan product. As you can see here, even as judged in the academic literature, those that had more passenger miles of public transit available are more competitive. It's one of the reasons we've been so resilient over the last 20, 30 years, and one of the reasons that we're continuing to be the top global investment market for real estate and for other activities. So there's no doubt that the region benefits from us executing Metro 2040. And what we've done, if you go to the next slide, is we've prepared some order of magnitude estimates for how we might get there. We know today, just to keep the system we have, keep that running and keep it running safely and to continue these investments, costs about $1 billion a year. So that's what we have today. We need to keep doing that. Our customers have told us that we owe it to the region. We can't not do that. On top of that, Metro 2025, our estimates suggest that for an additional $500 million a year, we can execute the vision of Metro 2025 and keep up with the next decade, decade and a half of growth, as well as ensure that we have remediated some of the capacity constraints that we're starting to witness today. For an additional $750 million a year and through 2040, what this allows us to do, again, conceptually, at this point in time, is to execute the vision of Metro 2040. And that is the transit system that this region needs in order to continue to grow and remain competitive. And so these estimates, of course, are preliminary in nature, but they suggest that on top of that billion, these incremental investments, or the significant investments, do not only convey the benefits to the region, but also results in that return on investment that we discussed earlier. And so with that, let's close up. What do we do with this going forward? Let's go to the next slide. The next steps for momentum include, first and foremost, continued information gathering. This is the beginning of a discussion. We're going to be continuing our outreach through public meetings, through presentations, through dialogues with our stakeholders and the business community and the advocacy groups, in conjunction with the FY 2014 budget, which you presented, as well as the online interactive dialogue for the next many months. We'd like to identify some topics for some future strategic discussions to really engage with this material and to have a meaningful dialogue and debate about how, what components and how we implement this. We certainly want to then take all that feedback and incorporate that into the final strategic plan, which we'd like to be able to deliver to this body by mid-2013. And then finally, to adopt momentum and to put it into implementation to guide the organization over the next 10 years. In the short term, last slide here, the upcoming outreach that is already scheduled, you can see that the congressional delegation, our jurisdictions, our public officials, our advocacy groups, we know we'll be we're on the schedule for meetings with the Board of Trade, with the D.C. Chamber of Commerce, and we've been contacting the other regional chambers, and hopefully we'll have those scheduled and firmed up in the near future. We'll be continuing to use the Momentum webpage and our email lists, as well as additional public meetings and newspaper buys, and we'll continue to go back to our employees and make sure that we're hearing internally the extent to which we can make adjustments, additions, tweaks, fine-tuning to this draft strategic plan and get this right. We're also planning to seek endorsements from our regional stakeholders, groups, and individuals to make sure that the region and the world knows that this has the support and endorsement of our regional leaders, and they believe it critical to the region's future. With that, we'll go to the last slide. That's our presentation of the staff draft at this point in time.
Terrific job, Sean. Thank you. Questions, comments? Mr. Bolger.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Great presentation. Learned a lot. Looks like you guys have really done a lot of work. I wanted to just zero in on one key point that you made, was the cost benefit that you, Sean, that you mentioned. You ran through it really quick. I think these are really great selling points, not only for us at the board level, but for our stakeholders. and our local governments, state governments, et cetera. So if you could, next time we get around to this, kind of polish that up a little bit for talking point purposes, commercial real estate enhancement, be interested in how you monetize time savings for our customers and for the and non-customers, for that matter. Congestion relief, lane, you know, the lane. I get the lane miles. I get the parking spaces, like garages. I understand that, but some of those other intangible points, I think the board. I know I would be really like to have those handy when we talk to our decision makers, and I think it changes the dynamic, the way we present what we need in a different way with all of those externalities that are not really externalities so much as we don't really talk in those terms that much. So, and a great presentation again. Thank you.
Ms. Hines.
Thanks. Let me echo Tom's compliments. I think this is really a very, very strong document, and it's a great place for us to begin what is, I think, the really hard conversation that needs to happen in the region. I have two things I'd like to see at some point, and perhaps maybe I'm too early, and I'm already thinking about playing this out, but. Really good strategic plans, I think, identify the performance measures and make that connection. We've got the KPIs, which go more to daily, you know, the regular operations. But I think for this to really stand strongly, it needs to have milestones and it needs to have performance measures that people can understand and sort of hold on to, because it's a long plan. I mean, 2040 is a long way out, but there's so many things that have to happen in order to achieve some of these 2025 goals. You know, it's not just buy the 8-car trains, it's get the power right and have the train storage. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff behind it that we know, but people need to understand that if you don't do this stuff in the front end, you're not going to get the thing you really want that we all understand in the end. So I think that part really needs to be laid out a little bit more clearly. The other thing that I have learned in the last several years is that for the general public, $500 million is too much money to understand. But I'll give you an example. In the state of Virginia, a penny on our sales tax generates $1 billion a year. Well, that's something people can put into their daily lives pretty easily and say, oh, so for me that means I'd be spending, you know, another couple hundred bucks a year, and in return I would get access to this thing that we all want together. And so I don't know what the array of choices might be. People sort of were saying, well, redirect something from something I'm already paying, which we all know is just, you know, shoving the pot around and means somebody else loses. But, you know, if everybody in the metro area were to add $10 to car registration, how much money would it generate? You know, if we had a half cent sales tax for the region, what would that mean in terms of dollars? Because I think then we begin to put it in real people's hands, and honestly, this funding thing is not going to get solved unless the general voting public steps up and says, we're willing to pay, because there is no cover for legislators without that in this climate that we're in. And so give us some more tangibles about those numbers. And then the last thing I would just say is I was confused about, do I need 500 million to 2025, and then after that I need 740? Okay, so clarify how much we're actually looking for beginning when.
Sure, the all good points, and I especially agree with making sure that the public can understand in digestible means what the funding looks like to them on a household budget basis. And that's something that we can certainly tackle, absolutely. As far as the funding chart, do we have that up right now? The way to read this is that $1 billion, you get to the system that you've got. for an additional $500 million a year, we can achieve the vision that's set up Metro 2025. And then an additional, on top of the $500 million a year, so it's essentially getting to $1.2 billion a year.
Starting now.
Okay. Some of the investments, it would make the most prudence to make sure that we coordinate those investments. We don't have to tear stuff down and rebuild it. So that's the way this is structured, or the slide is structured.
I just want to pick up on what Ms. Hines said about funding and making it tangible. I asked the governor of Maryland how much you get for a penny on the gas tax in Maryland. It's about $120 million. So it doesn't get you too far toward this, but if Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. all did a few pennies on the gas tax, we begin to see this kind of money. Mr. Dyke.
Yeah, I'd just like to piggyback a little bit on what Mary said, what you said, and it goes to next steps, and that is, I think the report is excellent. I think it's got a lot in here. I think we need to be focused on how do we sell this, and in Virginia, for example, what I would encourage us to do is to identify other forums around the rest of the state that are important, because the things that you just talked about as far as adding a cent on the sales tax or whatever it might be, those things have to be enacted by the state, and we need to let people know around the Commonwealth how important it is that Metro succeed, because this is sort of the core. It's Northern Virginia's the economic engine that drives the Commonwealth, and then when you carry it down through the Golden Crescent with your colleagues who the local officials have already spoken up about the need to invest in transportation, we've got to convince the rest of the state how important it is to invest in Metro, because to the extent it's more successful and it helps us become more of an economically competitive jurisdiction, it's going to benefit the rest of the state. But they need to understand that, and they need to know that. One example might be tie in for example, the Virginia State Chamber, which is launching now its blueprint, which is a statewide effort looking at economic development. It's looking at transportation. It's looking at education. But they're going all over the state talking about how important it is to address these issues. Metro needs to be a central part of that so that the rest of Virginia understands, the people who live in the Southwest and Southside understand that if Metro gets the support that's being articulated here, they're going to benefit because it's going to generate more money that will help them. So as we move to this next step of what do we do next, I think we need to think really broad, and we need to also talk about working with our delegation. I know Regina's working on that. How do we work with our congressional delegation to get them out there to be advocates for us at this point and take it to another level? But I'd like us to get into a little bit more of the specifics of how do we get all this stuff done. One other point, going back to one of your earlier slides where you talk about investing in our people and our assets, I'd like to see some more details on that, specifically as it relates to making sure that we've got a diverse leadership at WMATA, something that reflects the region. And I think we need to see some specifics on how we're going to get to that level, because that's an important issue to a number of our riders and constituents in this region. So I'd like to see a little more detail on that.
Sergeant.
Go ahead. Okay. I just wanted to congratulate you, because I think the message that you've given and what you've done in this document really sells the product that we have, and that's Metro for this region. And I think it's so important from the ground up. We've talked about the economic development part, but also for the community that we serve, for the riders every day, what does this mean for us, but also what we're going to do about it. I think the point that you've made about who and when will we be the voice for it, in an absence, someone else is going to step in. And we really need to be that voice as soon as possible to reflect what we're saying in this strategic plan and to show that it is a continuously evolving piece, that each time we are looking at this plan as a growth period forward, we're not going to say 2020 from now we're going to talk about it, but rather it's an everyday part of what we do, because I think we've had strategic plans in Metro. That was a strategic plan, I'm certain, that when the system was created. But how do we keep track of that How do we keep focused on that? And this gives us, I think, at least the workings to get there. And then lastly, the terms of the value we bring and who and how we convince everyone that that's the value that we bring. I was offline today. What would I offline at West Falls Church? What would my customer say 10 years from now at an interruption? How would they see it? What would they mean? What would it mean to them? And I think those are the gaps that we want to change. We want to we know the system is running well. We know the system is old. We know that we're rebuilding the system. But what we say in this strategic plan, our vision forward, is to bring that system back to its well understood value to the customer, to the economic development. And in doing that, the messaging that we have to bring is why, what, how. What happened? Why did it happen? And how do I get back to where I want to be in terms of using the system? And that confidence building we see is happening, but we have to continue to stay focused on that. And the same message in terms of value, as we've said around the table here. The region has had the opportunity to create a message of what it takes for stable revenue. And we've done it in pieces. We've done it in Virginia years ago. We've done it in the District of Columbia. We need to come together and find the mechanism, and Metro has to drive that message of how we come together to drive the message of the value that it returns to all of us in our jurisdictions. Thank you for the excellent presentation. They're very well given and done.
Mr. Downey?
Let me just add my congratulations to what you put together. I think it's a great start for a good discussion, and I think we, you had said we should send Shyam out to sell it. We all have to go out and sell it. We all have got to be out there making these kinds of presentations. And I think one of the things, just coming back to 2040, or I don't expect to be around, but I care about it. We need to, now in the next few months, get more comfortable with what's there, what's proposed, what it will mean to actual riders, tangible benefits and the way the system operates, as well as the regional economic benefits that it brings. Because we could sit here forever creating regional transit system plans. That's the sound of literally one hand clapping. We've got to have the support from those who make the funding decisions. This is an offering that we're bringing forward, but we've got to be able to tell them why it's important. The kinds of things that Jim was talking about are just absolutely critical, but we have to be able to say, what will it mean to those riders? What is the kind of service, level of service, the options that it will create? It's not just today's system a little bit expanded. It's a very different, expanded system for a future region, but getting our heads around that and getting the kind of information that will allow us to defend it from those who will say, this is pie in the sky, this has no reality, this has some particular flaw in it. We've got to have some good bulletproof analysis and presentation that really makes us comfortable selling it and selling the idea that if you don't make this investment, you're making a very serious mistake about the future of the region.
Yeah, that last point is so important. If we don't do this, what happens to our region, which is really bad. Ms. Porter.
Thank you. I agree with what everyone has said about commending you for the quality of this presentation and for the quality of the work that you've done. It's very good and very important. I also agree with the kinds of things that people have said about the major challenge in doing this, obviously, is going to be the funding. And I would agree with everything people have said about making the funding issues as clear as possible, bringing it down to the individual level. The piece that I would add to that is that my experience has been that the average member of the public has no idea what transportation infrastructure costs. They are orders of magnitude off in their understanding. And so the piece that I would add is we need to be really, I mean, at the local level, you talk about, you know, cost per linear foot to repave a road, and then you say, okay, and you've got so many thousand linear feet in front of your house, and so this is what it's going to cost. We need to figure out a way to explain to people why these things cost what they do. I mean, my colleagues who've been involved in these for years and years, these costs are not shocking to you. I can assure you that they are surprising to the average person. We really need to figure out a way to explain to people why things cost as much as they do. The other thing that I would say is that there's an issue here that is sort of only dealt with sort of peripherally, and that is looking at the issue of transportation or commuting from the suburbs into the core versus from suburb to suburb. Most of this deals with commuting from the suburb into the core, and yet the planning discussions that I've seen indicate that there will be much more suburb-to-suburb commuting in the future than is the case right now. And I understand that much of this is not going to be under our control. Metro is not going to be the agency that builds or controls or, you know, has responsibility for a lot of the suburb-to-suburb commuting. But it would be really important, I think, to talk about how we fit into what other jurisdictions are doing or may be interested in doing or want to do in order to do. I mean, I'm a good example. I live in eastern Montgomery County in Tacoma Park. For me to get to Rockville, I have to go all the way down into the central part of the city and back out again. Now there's a plan for a purple line, which would be very convenient for me. But it in a bigger sense, it sort of solves that problem of how do you get from one leg of the red line to the other leg of the red line. And I think we need to address some of those issues. We can't sort of just look at it from our perspective. It has to be a bit of a broader perspective. And that's the only area that I would expand it.
I think that's very fair. I do want to make sure that when you do get the moment to hone in, we certainly recognize that the suburb-to-suburb commute and trip generally is one that the rail network was never designed to handle,
right.
But we have to be prepared for it. We have proposed a few solutions that are not only metro-oriented but also are sponsored by jurisdictional partners that need to be embraced. Certainly some of the elements and many of the elements in the Metrobus Priority Corridor Network do immediately address and provide near-term high-quality mobility for those trips. We certainly need our jurisdictional partners to work with us to put the rights of way or allow the rights of way for those buses to move and move those passengers around. There are elements that are in Metro 2040, this conceptual plan, that do recognize the important the growth of the suburb-to-suburb trip generation. It's by no means complete yet, but we're getting there.
Thank you.
I want to recognize Ms. Hines and Ms. Hampshire-Callan then I think maybe we're going to have lots of opportunity to talk about the strategic plan. We've got to get to our consideration of our code of ethics, which we need to try to deal with today. Ms. Hines?
So, there's two quick things. The first one is
somebody said we have to all sell this. And I really encourage you to think of us as assets as you're planning these various meetings, and that there shouldn't be a meeting without a board member that's part of it. At least in terms of jurisdictional partners and other things, I think we need to be more engaged, we personally. The other question I have, Sean, is just Metro Access isn't mentioned a whole lot in our pages of, you know, here are the things we're going to work on, and maybe there's a way to make sure that that is a little bit more obvious, because obviously moving those folks, giving them mobility is a huge priority for the region, too.
Yeah, if it's not clear enough, it is not by willful omission. Certainly, in the full text of the report, we have not only highlighted the significant achievements that Metro Access has already accomplished, but also the critical role that it needs to continue to fill in the region. It's an award-winning service that has actually delivered operational efficiencies to the entire system, and if that didn't ring as clearly in the presentation, I hope that a full read of this document will make it ring clear.
Ms. Hampshire-Callan.
Good morning. All of my colleagues have commended the presentation, but I think it's important that you know that, at least for me, it was an enjoyable and interesting presentation, one of the best I've experienced as a board member. So that's a major statement. So you think people are just casually saying it was a nice presentation. Just two things I'd like to say that are really picking up on something Jim said. In Maryland, we have something called the Maryland Association of Counties, and we meet in the summer and the winter. And in the time that I've been on Metro, each time I somehow end up in a conflict with someone from Maryland who's not from the Capital Region. And it's really about, we all agree we need transportation and we need to do more, but most of them think we need roads and bridges, and I think we need more transit-oriented investment. So this issue Jim has raised is serious, it's real. And I think as we work through diminishing resources, you know, for states, we really have to go sell it. Because, I mean, in January, I had a conversation with someone from Southern Maryland, and the question I put to this person was, the average income you have, most of those people work in the district, and they park in Prince George's County, and you don't think you should help figure out how to fund Metro? I mean, is that basic? So I think that's really important work to do. The last thing, I don't want to disappoint Rich and not talk about employees again and strategic planning, because I think the strategic planning process is a gift and an opportunity to transform the workforce, but it is also almost 11,000 ambassadors telling this story. So one of the things that, you know, I wonder about, I know we did the town hall meetings, but is this an agenda item for every meeting in every office for every manager? This is real stuff that will really make a difference for how employees feel about working here, what they see as the future, but more importantly, they tell the story to everyone they encounter. Tremendous way to help tell this story. Thank you.
Great suggestions. When people complain to me about the cost of infrastructure, I ask them if they've priced repaving their driveway recently. You know, it gives you a tangible sense of what it costs to do something, because it's, you know. If there are no further, Mr. Giancola.
I'm sorry, I have to say this. I don't disagree with artists at all on the need for transit, but remember, we have a bus system that goes on roads and bridges, so we have to kind of have a balanced system, recognizing, you know, that there's certainly the rural areas that rely more on bus travel than they do on rail. So I just wanted to add that to it.
Thank you. The next item on our agenda is the Code of Ethics. So I'll ask our general counsel to come up and get organized, and I'm going to declare a 3-minute recess. We will reconvene the meeting of the committee, and I'm going to ask our general counsel to lead us into our consideration of amendments to the Code of Ethics.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Barnes and board members. I want to take a minute to orient everybody on all the paper that has been provided on this, because there is quite a bit of it. So the first thing, and just to recap what we were asked to do, you all know the Cadwalader report provided a number of ethics recommendations. And so what, and there's not going to be any presentation up there. So because the material is so dense, it's a little hard to actually do it on in bullet style. So the Cadwalader report made a number of ethics recommendations, and we did several things with them at the committee's direction. First thing we did was simply take the recommendations and put them in as a red line into the current ethics code. Additionally, in the footnotes to that document, and that looks like this, this is the ethics code, in the footnotes to on those documents, we've identified the policy issue, and we've actually tried to give as much of the Cadwalader recommendation itself, the actual language. So there's all that information for you on each page. And it's my preference to actually go through this document rather than, but I'll get to the other document soon, not that document. I'm talking about the Code of Ethics itself with redlining, which I hope everybody has.
Now, where do we find that?
It should be in your board book. Or
do we know which tab it's under?
Florida. Okay.
It's the first one?
Okay.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Okay. There is a lot of paper.
We killed a lot of trees.
What tab?
It should be understood. Yeah. Okay.
It's after the strategic plan in there.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, good. Now the second document is looks like this. It's a matrix, and what that has is each of the Cadwalader recommendations that represents what we think is a policy issue. And we can turn to that, and you may wish to turn to that, because what it also has is, under the title jurisdiction, it has the comparable provisions from Maryland, Virginia, and the district, as well as CTA and MTA, just as information. So, but I think, and I'm recommending, as far as going through this, it is better to actually deal with the markup of the Code of Ethics, because that gives you the context and you can readily refer to other provisions. So Bruce and Phil are actually going to walk through this for you. They've done all the work on preparation of the document, but there are a couple of things, and of course I'll chime in when I feel there's something that I can add. But there is something I want to start everybody with, because one of the first recommendations from the Cadwalader report talks about changing the definition of indirect financial interest. And part of the reason that part of the predicate for that recommendation is the Cadwalader firm felt that it wasn't quite consistent with the compact. So I want to do first what I always do in the Code of Ethics. So I want you to turn first to page four. I want you to look at the compact prohibitions. Bruce knows I always start with this with each of our discussions. So it's page four of the markup, and this is simply a direct quote from Section 10 of the compact. And the first thing that board members are prohibited from doing is being financially interested, either directly or indirectly, in any contract, sale, purchase, lease, or transfer of real or personal property to which the board or the authority is the party. Now, financially interested is not defined anywhere in the Code of Ethics. There are two other definitions, direct financial interest and indirect. Those are capitalized throughout the Code of Ethics. But for this provision, it is an absolute bar on any level or type of financial interest in a contract, sale, purchase, et cetera, to which the board is a party. So any contract that becomes before the board, any joint development, any sale, any purchase, a board member cannot have any interest in that whatsoever. It is not sufficient to recuse yourself. It is a prohibition. Your choices are to get rid of it or resign as a board member. Those are your choices. Recusal does not apply to this. So then, prior boards through the years have, in adopting first the code, the procedures, and then the Code of Ethics, have expanded that prohibition. And they've expanded that to Section C, which provides that no board member or household member may singly or in combination have a direct financial interest in a party. Now, and then we go on to having a direct or indirect financial in a party or prospective party to that financial transaction. So it is not just a prohibition to have an interest in the contract. This board and prior boards expanded the prohibition to having an interest in a party or for any of your household members or your business associates to have an interest in a party, a company, a joint venture, et cetera, that has a contract or some other financial relationship with WMATA. And that is where the 3% rules apply. So there's a cutoff to, and there's a, below that, the prior board members considered it was not a sufficient interest to cause a real conflict. If you do have that interest, you're able to recuse yourself from voting. But, and so I have never felt that that was in conflict with the compact because it doesn't run afoul of the direct prohibition of having a financial interest in the contract, sale, et cetera. It was an expansion that certainly has been around as long as I have, which is around 20 years, that prior boards determined to do in implementing the compact. So it's just important to keep that distinction in mind in considering some of the recommendations, but primarily the recommendation concerning the 3% rule, which is one of the first recommendations. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bruce and Phil, and what our intent is to start and get as far as we can with each of the Cadwalader proposals. The ones, again, that were thought to be policy issues, and I have to say that's most of them, most of the recommendations, were the ones that we provided comparison provisions from the signatories and a couple of other transit properties. So that's how this material is set up. We also, you should also have among your papers two separate comments, one from Ms. Bowser, who was not able to be here, and I believe, and then another set also from the District of Columbia, and I believe Mr. Bulger is going to raise those as appropriate, but you also have them in writing. And with that, I think we're going to start on start with each of the recommendations.
The one from the district we don't have.
So
we have something from Ms. Bowser.
Ms. Bowser, oh, I'm sorry, I neglected one more piece of paper. So apart from the Cadwalader recommendations, staff have a separate recommendation about gratuities. And that's a whole separate paper that will be discussed. I think our thinking was that Cadwalader made a point, but we didn't like the way they resolved it. So in terms of being clear, so that's yet an additional piece of paper. So with that, I think we can start.
Good morning. Just in case we do get to that additional piece of paper, that's about the gratuities, and that would begin on page, in place of the red line on page 6. So I suppose if I could draw your attention to page 2, which is the first redlining, which refers to indirect financial interest, which, as Carol noted, we've given a lot of thought to over the years. And the issue is always how far to draw the line, whether to take cognizance of some matters as too small not to rise to the level. I will note one other thing. So their proposal is to delete the 3% rule as far as indirect financial interest. That you can see that on the bottom of page 2. And their proposal is to broaden the definition of income earned. And they've changed it from income earned to income received to also include passive income. When it was previously conceived, it was more of a earnings of in that might be reported as earned income. They've changed that word to received. To, again, that's broadening the degree to which there is a reportable indirect financial interest. Yes, sir. Mr. Dyke.
In some company that was doing business with Metro, that you'd have to, in essence, you'd be prohibited from being involved in that?
That would be a direct, and if I can call your attention to page 2, to definition D, we have long excluded publicly traded. We have certain financial instruments that we just have recognized for a long time as being so generally dispersed, the nature of the interest, that we do not capture it. So that was in definition D. If you look on the,
wouldn't it be picked up on the indirect financial interest?
No,
not indirect. It's not direct.
That would be direct. If you own stock, ownership of stock, and the company and a company that is owned by the mutual. By a mutual fund that the mutual fund has an ownership interest in, is doing business with us, okay, that would be picked up as direct financial interest. And okay. But we have as a matter of definition, we have long excluded that.
Mr. Chairman.
But it also has a 3%. So let's go back. You can't have any interest in a particular contract. And I'll use contract in its broadest sense. Could be a procurement contract, sale, property, et cetera. You can have no interest in that. But you can't have an interest in a company that just generally does business with WMATA. And that's where the 3% rule is. So the 3% of that ownership interest is direct. If the indirect usually comes up when somebody is a subcontractor, for example, and provides services to a company that does business with WMATA. They can't do it on a contract with WMATA, but they might be working for a company that just generally does work for WMATA on some other matter, not involving WMATA. So it's what Mr. Dyke has raised is the second tier of control. Person who doesn't have an interest in the contract, a specific contract, but has an interest in a party that has a contract with WMATA. That's the direct, and it's the 3% rule is then triggered. And Cadwalader is recommending getting rid of that on the indirect. So the indirect is you do work for a company that has a contract with WMATA as a sub or something. Not necessarily on a contract, definitely not on a contract with WMATA, but, you know, a lot of companies that do business with WMATA are large, and they have interests all over, and you might, any board member might actually provide services to them, and then we get into the 3% rule. That's how we get there, either direct or indirect.
Yeah, well, that was the issue that I was concerned about, because if, for example, your law firm represents somebody that's working with a subcontractor, at least the 3% rule would, in most cases, not create a problem. But if we get rid of that, then that puts you in a fairly precarious position, I would think.
Yes.
Ms. Porter?
That's sort of my question also. I'm not understanding the relationship between the direct financial interest and the indirect with the changes proposed, because the way it's laid out now, it appears to me that if you have a direct financial interest under 3% of the total, what the total equity of the party, then you're okay. But if you have any indirect financial interest at all, one penny, you have a conflict. Is that correct? Because that makes no sense to me.
It is a difficult change that has been proposed, if I can say. Again, indirect generally comes up when somebody is provides services to one of WMATA's contractors on some different contract. And I think the proposal would be very difficult to apply.
Well, that goes to the point Mr. Dyke was making about, you know, if you're at a law firm or an accounting firm or whatever, and they happen to be a client of yours. Yeah. That's why I think retaining the 3% rule probably makes a lot of sense.
Well, the way we understand it, in terms of how we thought you were proceeding, is that if a board member does not make a committee member does not make a motion which passes the committee, that we're just going to pass on to the next proposal, to the next matter. That to adopt any of these requires affirmative action.
I don't hear a motion to adopt this change.
Right. Let the record reflect that I'm not making a motion on it.
The question is, could we take some of it? Because it seems to me that earned and received is a little, I understand that change, and it seems reasonable to me. But I'm a little concerned about taking out the 3%.
So you'd like to put the word received in and as an amendment to the...
Take out the word earned. The received thing seems to be a clarification, because then you don't have to figure out whether it's earned, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is there objection to that? Hearing none, so ordered. Ms. Hines, you had a...
I have another question, and this is actually the 3% as it's portrayed here of the members or the entity's gross income. It's always struck me as a little difficult to know what 3% of the entity's gross income is, and I have no difficulty leaving in the 3% of the members' gross income. I don't know how there would be any capacity to check on 3% of the entity's gross income. And we're saying whichever is lower, and my guess is the member is always going to be lower. So I don't know why we would fuss about the entity's gross income. Some of you who do this work maybe have a different perspective, but it just seems to me to be an unnecessary complication in this particular instance.
Well, just by way of reference, this might be a moment that you might want to look at the comparison documents. Maryland, and I should say, you know, we struggled to find comparative language. Sometimes the match was better than others. The Maryland language refers to ownership of more than 3% of an entity, and it does not, the Maryland language does not distinguish between direct and indirect. So it does not have the specificity of the income being received, but that 3% there is does refer to the ownership interest, which might also be hard to determine in a publicly traded entity.
So it's really about 3% ownership of the entity as opposed to 3% of the entity's gross income?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the distinction that's up in D.
Right.
Right? So maybe that's the solution for what just strikes me as a really weird problem, is to say 3% of the member's gross income or the member owns 3% of the equity in the company is a lot clearer and easier to calculate than 3% of the entity's gross income.
The other option is a flat amount, but I think you can, which Virginia picks up and CTA, but I think you can.
We had a lot of conversation about that the last time.
Correct.
And, as I've said repeatedly, I'm held to the 10,000 and have to report everything and do, and that's just life. But we had other people who felt very strongly. They worked for multiple consulting firms. They did, they were making more than 10. They didn't want to list it all. In the interest of transparency, I don't understand why, but that was the conversation we had the last time. Personally, I would prefer $10,000 and just be done with it myself. But I don't think that is how necessarily all of the board feels.
So
it's a lot clearer.
Mr. Downing?
Yeah, I want to explore further the indirect issues. Obviously could affect me, but we've resolved it in the past. I want to be sure we can continue to resolve it. If you are doing business with a firm who does business with Metro, is it sufficient to just recuse yourself from any actions that might involve that firm, or do we have to dig more deeply into that?
Well, the problem is there's actually a threshold. So the idea is you're fine as long as you don't trigger the threshold. Right, the 3% threshold. If you have more than that, then I don't think the idea is that you just recuse yourself. If you keep below, you're fine, and you recuse yourself. The clear intent of the ethics is you do not have a larger interest in any company that does business with Lamont. Except for the excluded companies, and as Bruce pointed out, but that relates to direct and indirect. There are a number of direct interests that are excluded from really any consideration because they're not considered of the type that would affect a board member's judgment. Those are indirect financial interests, checking, savings, IRAs, things like that. But that's the importance of the 3% rule. I mean, it allows and recognizes that board members or work across the jurisdictions. They have sometimes multiple roles, and we do want to be able to have qualified board members. So there has to be a rule, and it seems a good extension of the compact to address interests in parties that do business with WMATA as opposed to interests in the transaction itself. But there was an acknowledgement that there should be a limit to that. So 3% was used.
I would also like to note that the 3% has also been long used for the employee standards of conduct. And it has. And I think we have felt that it's a demarcation between before you get to sizable. That's I think, why the number has. But that number has long figured in both the employee definitions of direct and indirect as well.
So further discussion on this point, Mr. Porter?
Is there a reason that the exclusions are not in the indirect, the checking and savings accounts, money market accounts, other demand deposits are not in the indirect as well as the direct? Because presumably if you could be getting, you know, a lot, you could be getting interest or something from a checking account. And would that would cause you to have a conflict?
Well, I think the reason is that the general thought is that the direct interests are ownership interests in entities, whereas the indirect are really income interests from services. That's generally what has been what the Code of Ethics has attempted to capture. So you don't have a direct interest because you don't have an ownership interest in a company, but you may receive income from a particular company. Now, actually, I hadn't thought about incorporating those exclusions, but I suppose the reason is because that intent has always been to capture income from a law firm, a consulting arrangement, things of that nature. And not to try to preclude those relationships, because keep in mind, this goes beyond the compact. It's not, but the sense of the board has always been nevertheless to put a limit on that indirect income.
So someone with a large savings account in a bank that did interest, that did work with Metro could be in violation of this.
If it exceeds 3%, yes.
How could that exceed 3%?
Right.
I can't imagine that circumstance where it would exceed 3%.
Well, actually, let me rephrase that. Again, the indirect financial interest, you're excluding from that checking or savings, money market accounts, demand deposits, IRAs, government bonds, certificates of deposit, publicly traded mutual funds, and government pensions, or other income received pursuant to a government retirement program. Those are not, you can have all those interests and then it can exceed 3% and you're not in violation of the rule. So your direct financial interest has to be in an entity other than those, and that's where the 3% comes in.
Mr. Bolton.
Again, I guess I just need to ask, how in, would we ever, let me rephrase. So I'd have to hire my corporate accounting company and pay them to determine the 3% threshold.
3% of a company is hard. I agree
no,
with
I'd
that.
Have to if this ever came in my lap, I would have to hire a corporate accounting company to do a calculation on some yet-to-be-determined format, which we don't know what the format would look like. We'd have to get the books opened and pay them to tell me, if it ever came to be, how the 3% would be met or
you'd have to know your gross income or your company's gross income. Those are the two things.
Okay, so that's incumbent upon a board member's own responsibility to do that calculation yet to be established. We don't have the rules on how that calculations would be formatted.
Well,
we don't know how that would work, which is all up in the air.
You're talking about the current 3% rule.
Yeah.
Right. It's gross income is not defined.
Right.
But it does require the individual to know their own gross income. If they're working for a company, they have to find out what the gross income of the company is, because that's the way it's set up.
All right, well, let's get real definitional here. I mean, is this C corporations, S corps, LLCs? What's the rule to make this calculation work one way or the other from a business perspective?
Well, if the concern is about the current language, and there is that issue, it's always been there. If somebody feels that they're working for a company that has a relationship with WMATA, and that relationship might produce more than 3% of their gross income for that company,
mm-hmm.
that becomes a concern, and I could see how it would be appropriate if this if the current rule is kept,
mm-hmm.
to define gross income. That's something we certainly could come up with.
Although Ms. I don't know if it was Ms. Hines or Ms. Porter was suggesting, instead of looking at the corporate entity's gross income, you looked at the members' relationship, ownership interest in the corporate.
Right.
And that
that's a good clarification.
If you want, I have written. I could read to you a revised version, which seeks to adopt that. So indirect financial interest means income received. So that's the income received by a member or by a member on behalf of an entity for services provided to a party when that income exceeds 3% of the member's gross income, or the member has a 3% interest in the entity receiving the income.
We probably need to be consistent in party and entity too, that there's not use party and entity interchangeably,
right.
but be consistent throughout on that. I think you have the idea, Bruce. It's not elegant, but
okay.
I think you got the idea.
It's not just it has a 3% interest, it has an interest in excess of 3%.
Yes. It has an interest in excess. It has an ownership interest in excess of 3%.
It is.
Well, but we're talking about the income received by
right.
another entity, not by...
Yeah,
not received by your, not relating to what you own, but the ownership interest here is I was trying to capture was your ownership of an entity that is receiving income.
Mr. Barnes.
So, Mrs. Porter, just to help us and be sure, if the sense of the committee is to go with that, could you restate what you were proposing? On the change to, it was 3% of the member's income, or?
Where I thought we were going, I don't have an objection to that. I don't quite understand it, I think is why. But what I was thinking, where I thought we were going is just scratching out or entities and scratching out whichever income is less. So it would just say a party when that income exceeds 3% of the member's gross income for the current or preceding fiscal year.
And that would certainly be a clarification. And all we would have to do then is come up with a definition of gross income that would satisfy the committee. This is a clarification. Although if it's an individual gross income, we could use an IRS definition or something like that.
Yeah, presumably you could use that.
Okay. I know with respect to law firms, I'm not sure how it works for other firms, but with law firms, the gross incomes are published every year. You can read what the firm brought in last year. Bruce, you have a sense of where we're going there and we can move on?
Yes, Mr. Barnes.
Okay.
I just want to note that for when we bring a draft back to you, we're going to bring a draft which includes a definition of gross income.
And we'll delete or entities gross income, whichever
yes.
is.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So I note the time. I'm not sure what the board's pleasure is.
Well, Madam Chair, we're scheduled to adjourn about now. We haven't gotten very far on this. What's your pleasure? Should we take a little while longer, or do we need to go now to the board meeting?
I think we do have someone that would be part of the presentation. So another 5 to 10 minutes.
We try to take one more item here? And
Mr. Barnes, I would note the next matter is somewhat difficult.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
So I'm not sure.
Contrast,
I mean,
really
it's not.
Maybe we better adjourn and let the board, and we'll reconvene on this. This is very important, and we need to do it right. So.
What do we do on the 3%?
Yeah, I think we have to keep Mr. Boulder, this is the sense of the committee. On the 3%, the Mrs. Porter suggested on the current language, the current language in our code, that we would delete the language after members. So it would read, when that income exceeds 3% of the members' gross income for the current or preceding fiscal year, we would define gross income. And additionally, the proposal from Cadwallader, the new language, which says this income can be received by the member or by a party that the member is employed or has a financial interest in, that proposal was to keep that language. So we have to just really have to think about whether that's totally consistent with the last change that was made and work on that if it's not when we come back.
Okay, thank you.
So we're going to define what gross income is from what perspective? From an individual's perspective,
yes,
or individual, a corporate perspective?
No, only the individual, because we are deleting the reference in here to corporate income, to the entity's gross income. That language in I is...
Yeah, but the addition... Well, we'll work on it and come back consistent with the recommendations.
Mr. Barnes?
Ms. Hines.
I'm having flashbacks to how difficult this was 2 years ago. And might I suggest that each group of representatives from jurisdictions or signatories between now and our February 14th meeting, which is when we're going to have to come back to this, at least help us a little bit by doing as the district has done and giving us a first cut on what their position is. Because then we can figure out which ones we really have to spend a lot of time on and which ones we can kind of say, you know, there's no support for making these changes and have people say why instead of belaboring the language. And if people have language changes, if they could submit them, that would actually help everybody too, because that will give them time to look at it and figure it out so we have a good proposal before us. I just think that'll, otherwise,
that's a good suggestion.
How painful it will be.
I think this is a little flavor of it, and we all went through this a couple years ago, so.
It's just hard, it's hard stuff, and you have to think about it in advance, and so I think we'd all be so if
we
could
45 minutes on an item that I thought would be a 5-minute item, so.
It's tricky.
So, you never know.
Could have told you.
The committee will stand adjourned.